Victory or death!
Victory or death! Victory or death! Victory or death! Victory or death! Victory or death! Victory or death! Victory or death! Victory or death! Victory or death!
That's right, ladies and gentlemen. Victory or death. Welcome to Radio Free Virginia. I'm your host, Hank Reardon, the voice of freedom behind enemy lines in the Commonwealth of Virginia, equipping the patriots here and outside the wire with the tools you need in the fight to preserve your liberty. This is episode 21-18, the 18th episode of 2021. If you just stumbled across this podcast, one of the best ways to listen regularly is using the Podbean app or going to Podbean, but it's also available on Stitcher and various other places where podcasts are found. Please tell your friends and share this with others, as that's the best way that this can get out there. If you have any comments for me, you can send them to producer@radiofreevirginia.com. You can find out more about the show as well at radiofreevirginia.com. I'd like to thank the show sponsor, Acticare of the Blue Ridge, acticare.com/blue-ridge. Acticare is in-home senior care for your loved one when you can't be there. Get in touch with them if you live in Roanoke, Bedford, Campbell, Smith Mountain Lake, you're out in the country. Get in touch with John and his team, and they will take good care of you. acticare.com/blue-ridge. I'm going to talk about a couple different things today. As of this recording, we have no update for you on the latest Republican stuff. They just had their drive-through convention, and there's been no word yet about who has won that. Not that I could find. Looked around. So when I have that, probably the next episode, I'll be able to pass that on to you. My prediction, probably Pete Snyder, Jason Miaris, or the two that I can think off the top of my head. And then I don't know about the rest. We'll see. I'm going to jump in here to a thing called the Long Telegram. It's a man named Kenan, might be pronounced Kenan. And this was about the Soviet Union. And it was actually a giant long telegram. Telegrams are meant to be short. This is anything but. I'm going to snip out the things that I thought were relevant to today. And where it says USSR, I'm just going to replace the word communists. Communists still live in antagonistic capitalist encirclement, with which in the long run there can be no permanent peaceful coexistence. As stated by Stalin in 1927 to a delegation of American workers, in course of further development of international revolution, there will emerge two centers of world significance, a socialist center drawing to itself the countries which tend toward socialism, and a capitalist center drawing to itself countries that incline toward capitalism. Battle between these two centers for command of world economy will decide fate of capitalism and of communism in entire world. I should read that with an accent, because it's almost got one. Battle between two centers for command of world economy will decide fate of capitalism and of communism in entire world. So that's an interesting pull quote there from one of the most evil men. In fact, I would say more evil than Adolf Hitler. And Hitler was a bad dude, horrible person, just despicable. But Stalin was worse. And when you talk about how many people that man is responsible for the death of, it's probably in the 50 million range. He was just a horrid, awful person. In fact, I read this really interesting article this week about how, you know, we all heard that, well, you know, Germany invaded and attacked Russia. And that's true. But what they don't tell you in that is that there's a lot of strong evidence that Russia, the Soviet Union, was preparing and amassing to attack Germany and all of Europe, actually. So Germany said, I don't think so, and invaded and attacked Russia. I think their problem was is that they they wanted to actually get in there and conquer. And what they should have worked on is just destroying their war machine and then moving on. But it's a good thing they didn't. It's a good thing that they did that. It helped us to defeat them because they were so stretched thin there. This is another quote, but this is basically a section of the propaganda that the Soviet communists are putting out. Among negative elements of bourgeoisie capitalist society, most dangerous of all are those whom Lenin called false friends of the people, namely moderate socialists or social democratic leaders. In other words, non-communist left wing. These are more dangerous than out-and-out reactionaries, for the latter, at least, march under their true colors. What they're saying here is that the out-and-out leftists, or, you know, communist-leaning types, they march with a big flag that says, this is who I am. And then it says, whereas moderate left-wing leaders confuse people by employing devices of socialism to sane interests of reactionary capital. So we can, hey, we can all work together here. A little bit of socialism, you know, moderate types. And so what they're saying is in their propaganda that these people are bad because they're not true fellow travelers. They're not true dupes and suckers that can help advance the cause of communism. There's a good line here. This is a very long telegram, and some of it's quite boring, but you can actually see a lot of what happened in history by reading it, because this was written around the time of, I believe, the Berlin Airlift. So what, the 50s? They have learned to seek security only in patient but deadly struggle for total destruction of rival power, never in compacts and compromises with it. Impatient but deadly struggle for total destruction of rival power. This is exactly the model that the Chinese have adopted. A patient and deadly struggle for the total destruction of us. And we're paying them for it. We're actually paying them to accomplish this goal. This, if you think of I Led Three Lives, this quote here says, whereas formerly foreign communist parties represented a curious mixture of conspiracy and legitimate activity, conspiracy would be hiding out, you know, secretly working to foment revolution. Now the conspiratorial element has been neatly concentrated in inner circle and ordered underground, while rank and file no longer even taken into confidence about realities of the movement are thrust forward as bona fide internal partisans of certain political tendencies within their respective countries, genuinely innocent of conspiratorial connection with foreign states. Only in certain countries where communists are numerically strong do they now regularly appear and act as a body. As a rule, they are used to penetrate and to influence or dominate, as case may be, other organizations less likely to be suspected of being tools of the Soviet government, with a view to accomplishing their purposes through organizations rather than by direct action as a separate political party. Now, we do have the Communist Party of the United States. We have that here. But what this is saying, and what we know from I Led Three Lives, is that when they went underground, the vast majority of the people that are part of this nonsense are pushed off to the side and are doing, they're not told of what's really going on. And so they selectively pick and choose people to bring to the inner circle. But for the most part, it's just a bunch of dupes, a bunch of suckers that really don't know what's going on. And that's true today, but that's definitely what they were doing then. We see it when we're reading I Led Three Lives. In foreign countries, communists will, as a rule, work toward destruction of all forms of personal independence, economic and political or moral. Their system can handle only individuals who have been brought into complete dependence on higher power. Thus, persons who are financially independent, such as individual businessmen, estate owners, successful farmers, artisans, and those who exercise local leadership or have local prestige, such as popular local clergymen or political figures, are anathema. What jumped out at me when I read this was Zimbabwe. This is, you know, they made everybody now 100% is dependent on the state. And interestingly, Zimbabwe is saying, oh, wait a minute, we changed our minds. Hey, white farmers, can you come back? Because everybody's starving. I wouldn't go back if I was one of those white farmers. And I saw another article that said a lot of these white farmers have moved up to Zambia, and Zambia is being quite prosperous right now because they have successful people that know how to farm and know how to run a farm. But this idea, we see this here in America now, where working towards the destruction of all forms of personal independence, economic, political, or moral. We're seeing this right now here in America in regards to all kinds of stuff. You're stripping away independence, whether that's economic or political. You're not allowed to think for yourself anymore. You will toe the party line or else. Final ending quote here from one of the last paragraphs. It says, much depends on health and vigor of our own society. World communism is like a malignant parasite which feeds only on diseased tissue. This is point at which domestic and foreign policies meet. Every courageous and incisive measure to solve internal problems of our own society, to improve self-confidence, discipline, morale, and community spirit of our own people, is a diplomatic victory over the communists worth 1,000 diplomatic notes and joint communiques. That's ultimately right there the problem that America faces, the problem that Virginia faces, is we need to work to strengthen our own communities, the spirit of our own people. And we're not doing that at all. We have no self-confidence, discipline. Our morale is in the tank, especially from a conservative standpoint. So ultimately here, what does that tell? The communists are winning. That's what that tells us. The communists are winning. And we see it. We see it politically. We see it individually, collectively, morally. In every aspect of our society, we see they're winning. And at the moment, yeah, there's no more Soviet, Russian, USSR. There's no more of those communists. But there's plenty of communists in our own society. And there's plenty of them in China funding those dirtbags.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Herbert A. Philbrick.
The communists are past masters at getting other people to do their dirty work for them. They take over organization after organization in America in just two steps, infiltration and agitation. This is what they work at day and night. This is what accounts for much of their success. Because we have it on no less authority than J. Edgar Hoover that communists and fellow travelers have penetrated every category up there and more. Well, you think a few maybe. But it doesn't take many. It has been tragically proven time and again that one dedicated communist in a key spot, such as Alger Hiss in the State Department, or Harry Dexter White in the Treasury Department, or in any position to influence command decisions, can wreck our hopes, slaughter our soldiers, and weaken our nation.
And now we continue with I Led Three Lives. There's only two chapters left, chapter 19 and chapter 20. 20 is the epilogue, kind of the what happened after. And chapter 19 is about the testimony. And we continue. Chapter 19, My Testimony. The Federal Bureau of Investigation, my own pronouncement of those words echoed back to me in the vastness of the Foley Square courtroom. Under Prosecutor Frank Gordon's careful priming, I had exploded a bombshell in the faces of the 11 Communist Party leaders facing trial for conspiracy against the United States. Within a few minutes after I took the stand, it was written in the record that I had been a member of the Communist Party and that throughout that time I had been in constant communication with the Federal Bureau of Investigation. The top 11, ranged behind the long defense table, glared at me as I gave the preface for my testimony of those 9 years. I sat back in the witness chair. The tension eased in my throat as a great weight rolled off my shoulders. It was more than a momentary relief. For 9 years, I had sealed my lips on those words. The Federal Bureau of Investigation, scarcely daring to utter them, even in closest privacy. Now, for the first time, I was permitted to speak them in public. With five words, I was able to shrug off the burden of those 9 years and to square myself with my family, my friends, and the world. It was the end of the tightrope for me, but it was a cause of consternation among the 11. The rest was so much an anticlimax to me after the secret was out that I scarcely sensed the drama that gripped the courtroom when I started my testimony as the government's first surprise witness. The next morning, Walter Arm reported it in the New York Herald Tribune. His appearance, Mr. Arm wrote, was a complete surprise to the defense. Defendants and their counsel stared at the soft-spoken agent, first incredulously and then in evident distaste. They whispered among themselves and shook their heads. A member of the defense committee tiptoed from the courtroom and hurried to a telephone. The government's sense of timing had been perfect. Luis Budenz, disenchanted communist who quit the party after long association, renouncing the convictions he had once held, had been the first witness. But the defense was prepared for him, and attorneys for the 11 maintained their arrogant attitude through his testimony. Then the Department of Justice placed me on the stand. I was the first FBI informant to testify. Not a party malcontent either, but a FBI contact who had been opposed to communism and communists from the beginning. It was the first time that the government had ever publicly acknowledged that it had undercover agents actually working inside the Communist Party. There were similar witnesses to be surfaced, 7 in all, but I was to be the first. Until I took the stand, at a little after 2 o'clock on April 6, 1949, I was a member in good standing of the Communist Party in the United States. Until that moment, the comrades, despite any suspicions, had no certain proof that intelligence operatives were behind their lines, watching their important moves. The outraged astonishment at the defense table was well-founded. Mr. Arm reported that my first statements on FBI activities drew an audible gasp from the left side of the spectators' bench, a section generally filled with relatives and friends of the defendants, with their fellow travelers. Throughout his testimony, the defendants slumped in their chairs and watched him silently. The five defense lawyers, however, were far from silent. They were constantly on their feet with objections to the testimony as constituting prejudice and unfair surprise. Judge Harold R. Medina was kept busy overruling them. The initial testimony established that I had been a member of the Communist Party in New England for FBI intelligence purposes. Mr. Gordon then began to draw from me the account of what I had learned during those 9 years. Luis Budenz had furnished basic material for the record, describing the organization of the Communist Party in the United States and naming the 11 defendants as its top leaders, comprising what Budenz called the Politburo. I was to carry on from there. The indictment against the 11 contained 10 counts, of which the first was all-inclusive. It charged that the Communist Party leaders unlawfully, willfully, and knowingly did conspire with each other to organize as the Communist Party of the United States of America, a society, group, and assembly of persons who teach and advocate the overthrow and destruction of the government of the United States by force and violence, and knowingly and willfully to advocate and teach the duty and necessity of overthrowing and destroying the government of the United States by force and violence. My testimony, as we worked it out in long pretrial conferences, had two main purposes. First, I was to contribute all that I could from my experience to the conspiracy aspect of the indictment, to show that the party operated in secret, met behind closed doors in private apartments, organized itself on an underground pattern, and spread its doctrines not openly, but by planned subterfuge. I was to trace the dissolution of the reformist Communist Political Association in 1945 and the reconstruction under a carefully prepared and preconsidered plan of the Communist Party, a party dedicated, according to the indictment, to the Marxist-Leninist principles of violent revolution. Second, but of no less importance, I was to contribute my testimony to the weight of evidence regarding what the Communist Party taught and advocated in the meetings which I attended. We were to introduce as exhibits numerous books and pamphlets used by me in secret training schools with communist comrades, material which, over the years, I had bundled up and passed along to the Federal Bureau of Investigation. I was to discuss the teachings in those communist textbooks and tell how the most pertinent and most revolutionary ideas expressed in them were defined, expanded, and explained by party instructors. To the tune of running commentary of objections from the battery of defense lawyers, we began with the dissolution of the Communist Political Association and the reconstruction of the full-fledged Revolutionary Communist Party. The defense even objected to the admission into evidence of my membership card in the Communist Political Association, the card that I had spared from the wastebasket in Alice Gordon's apartment, and sent it to the FBI. Defense objections designed to throw everybody in the courtroom off track and to confuse the judge, the witnesses, the prosecution, and the jury were typified by the exchange over my CPA card. The court. Is Mr. Philbrick's name on it? The witness. Just the first name. The court. Just the first name? The witness. I think. Mr. Gordon. Yes. That card just says Herb. Mr. Satcher for the defense. I thought Your Honor saw it. The court. Well, to tell the honest truth, I did see it, and I didn't notice that part. I suppose you will take exception to that. I didn't notice that part. Is that all right? Mr. Crockett, another defense attorney. I do take exception to Your Honor's ruling. The court. You see, Mr. Satcher starts something. He made the remark that he thought I had looked at it, and how funny it was that I hadn't noticed the name Herb there. You see, one thing starts another, and then one of your numbers starts it with the others to get up and take the opposite view and do the old whipsaw game. Mr. Crockett, I object to the court's remark. And so it went. But they were unable to obscure the fact that I had been a member of the old Communist Political Association, the fact that I received a personal invitation from Dave Bennett to attend the New England Convention of the Association in July of 1945, or that the entire convention was rigged in advance by the party leadership. I testified to the details of the convention, including my observation that it was necessary for each speaker to write his name on a card and send it to the chair before he could gain the floor. I told the court that before any delegate could participate in the convention panel discussions, he was required to organize his material in advance, and that this was the device for the district leadership to determine what speakers were going to say what before they said it. The defense objected strenuously to both lines of testimony, but Judge Medina permitted them to stand. I recalled the Duclos letter, Anne Burlack's abject acceptance of its decrees, and her demand for the return of the party to the principles of Marxism-Leninism. My testimony included the vote at the state level on the dissolution of the CPA, the reconstitution of the party both nationally and in the district, and the establishment of the New England organization. After my testimony, linked with that of the other witnesses, had helped to nail down the charge that the 11 had deliberately reestablished the Communist Party for revolutionary purposes, Mr. Gordon led me into full details of the teachings within the secret session of the party. He introduced the complete outline for the teaching training course at No. 3 Hancock Street. It was at this point in the trial, from the four-year-old report to the bureau that I had written out with shaking fingers, that the government drew up for the jury the definition of revolution, as the term was understood by communists. Anticipating a defense argument that revolution meant peaceful reform, Mr. Gordon took me back to the Hancock Street School where, under the glare of a naked light bulb, Fanny Hartman posed the question, "What do we mean by revolution?" He asked me what the class teacher said, and I testified. The teacher defined revolution as a violent revolution to be carried out by bands of armed workers against the existing state government. The defense counterattacked swiftly with a simple motion to strike out my testimony, but Judge Medina repulsed it with an equally simple denied. At the end of my first day on the witness stand, I was taken in close custody again by my FBI bodyguards, bundled out of the building the same way I had come in to avoid newspaper reporters, and kept under guard through the night. The party, meanwhile, scurried around Boston trying desperately to find out just who I was. Some of the pro-group members were so shocked to find they had been infiltrated by the FBI that they could not believe that their comrade Herb and the witness Philbrick were the same man. Still, others had worked closely with me in front groups for many years without ever knowing me as a communist. When the district leadership recovered from the shock a few days later, they started a determined campaign of vilification in an effort to discredit me as a witness. But it was all vitriol and had no foundation in fact. In leaflets and flyers distributed in Boston and New York, they called me a cheap informer, spreader of fantastic tales, present-day Judas, stool pigeon, labor spy, and wormy character, among other things. But they did not refute my testimony, and ultimately, in order to save face, the party, rather than deny I had ever been a member, admitted it by announcing publicly that I was officially expelled Thus, they were forced to confirm the fact that I had been a member in good standing. Thursday morning in the courtroom, the testimony went deeper into the teachings of the Communist Party, particularly into those of the Hancock Street School, where I had been trained as an instructor in Marxism. Now Mr. Gordon began bringing into evidence the documentary material in the form of classic literature of the party, the books and pamphlets which were used throughout the party as instruction manuals, a word which was abhorrent to the defense and which they repeatedly tried to expunge from the record. The first one was Karl Marx's Communist Manifesto. It aroused a futile defense battle to keep out of evidence a document which they said is over 100 years old and is regarded as a classic of economic and political discussion. They claimed that its admission would simply place the ideals of Karl Marx on trial, but again, Judge Medina overruled them. Mr. Gordon brought out for me that we studied the Communist Manifesto and other works in the party library, not as dead history, but as material that was never out of date. With this established, he then read from the work. In short, the communists everywhere support every revolutionary movement against the existing social and political order of things. The communists disdain to conceal their views and aims. They openly declare that the ends can be attained only by forcible overthrow of all existing social conditions. The defense seized its prerogative to read from other portions of the manifesto, which Mr. Gordon had omitted. It was a maneuver obviously intended to bolster the defense contention that history was taught as history, and that the party's teachings were in the nature of peaceable intellectual discussions. But much of their reading merely served to strengthen the government's case. Although the first-hand personal experience testimony of the counter-spies played the larger part in convicting the defendants, their own textbooks were vital factors. One of the most condemning books offered in evidence was my original classroom copy of History of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, Bolsheviks. Passages stressed in classes I attended were marked in the book, and Mr. Gordon excerpted them for the jury. Hence, he read, in order to not err in policy, one must look forward, not backward. Further, if the passing of slow quantitative changes into rapid and abrupt qualitative changes is the law of development, then it is clear that revolutions made by oppressed classes are a quite natural and inevitable phenomenon. Hence the transition from capitalism to socialism and the liberation of the working class from the yoke of capitalism cannot be effected by slow changes, by reforms, but only by a qualitative change of the capitalist system by revolution. Hence, in order not to err in policy, one must be a revolutionary, not a reformist. Defense counsel Harry Satcher persisted in his reading of other long portions of the book, including the critical communist phrase that everything depends upon the conditions, the time, and the place. Mr. Gordon immediately countered by asking me what I had been taught about the historical timings of revolutions. Thus, with an assist from the defense, the jury learned that the Communist Party visualized two circumstances as being pregnant with revolution. First, a serious economic depression, and second, a war which could be converted into a civil war directed at the overthrow of the existing order. The catalog of inflammatory literature and party teachings continued, from Stalin's Foundations of Leninism, properly introduced as the very book used by me in the Hancock Street School. The prosecution brought out Stalin's view that Lenin is therefore right in saying that the proletarian revolution is impossible without the violent destruction of the machinery of the bourgeoisie state and its replacement by new machinery. He condemned the party again by this passage from the same book. Only the revolutionary party of the proletariat can serve as the general staff. The working class without a revolutionary party is an army without a general staff. The party is the general staff of the proletariat. From the Hancock Street School and the Malden and Melrose cells of the party, Mr. Gordon traced my admission into the sanctum of the professional group, Pro 4. We touched on the study there of Lenin's State and Revolution. I was permitted to testify with the book in front of me to refresh my recollection, although the defense battled constantly to have the book put aside. "Don't worry," Judge Medina said to me. "You have a right to look at the book if you want to." We piled evidence on evidence. "Such a course of events," I read into the record, "compels the revolution to concentrate all its forces of destruction against the state power and to regard the problem as one not of perfecting the machinery of the state, but of breaking up and annihilating it." The policy I had followed throughout my long years as a bureau informant, of turning into the bureau every scrap of documentary material that came my way, no matter how trivial it seemed at the time, paid off handsomely in the trial and enabled me to give far more detailed testimony than otherwise would have been possible. I was able to draw for the jury the picture of the pro group, its secret meetings in members' apartments, its breakdown into smaller groups of no more than 5 members, and its plans for speedy mobilization in case of emergency. The colonization program in key industries in the Boston area was sketched in a highlight of the Communist Party's program for increasing its potential strength to destroy. Finally, on Friday morning, after I had 4 sessions on the stand, the state finished my direct examination, climaxing it with the account of Martha Fletcher's tirade on civil disobedience and hammering home for the jury the fact that Martha and her comrades, when they spoke of fomenting civil strife, were unmistakably talking about civil disobedience in the United States. "You may examine," Mr. Gordon said. The defense was taken by surprise that the direct examination ended so abruptly, with the government satisfied to drive home a few cardinal points. There was a whispered conference at the defense table, and then cross-examination was started. It appeared to have 3 main objectives: to learn how the Federal Bureau of Investigation operates, and to examine the Bureau's files, to find flaws in the testimony, and to discredit me as a paid informant of the government. They began with a long fishing expedition into my employment status. Endeavoring to characterize me as a lackey of big business, I was questioned closely on my relationship with the FBI, and the defense finally demanded to see reports that I had submitted to the Bureau. This endeavor to open secret government files was firmly denied by Judge Medina. The judge, on the other hand, gave the defense every possible assistance in trying to establish whether I was paid large sums by the Bureau for my work. Defense Attorney Crockett demanded to know how much I paid for my house and car and even my motion picture camera. It cost $20. And projector, $90. "Mr. Crockett," the judge asked, "is it your intention to follow through all the things that the witness may own and find out how much he paid for them, and then draw certain inferences from that?" "No," the defense counsel replied. "I do not propose to go through all of these things that he may own and how much they may cost. I did want to find out when he suddenly, or strike suddenly, when he took on this hobby of motion pictures." "Well," the court replied, "I don't think you need to strike the suddenly. I think I get the drift of what you're working up to, just as Mr. Gordon did, and it is perfectly proper. If this man has been receiving large sums of money from the FBI or from the government, I think it is perfectly proper to bring that out, and I will allow you all the latitude you desire to do so." But it did not work. I testified flatly that I never received funds from the Bureau beyond reimbursement for my expenses. On redirect examination, Mr. Gordon examined my finances in detail. The defense was unable to discredit my testimony, and in fact made little effort to refute what I had reported. When I finally stepped down from the stand on Tuesday, after 4.5 days and 582 pages of testimony in the transcript, the defense moved to throw all of it out of court together with the supporting exhibits. The only grounds they could muster to support their motion were that the information that forms the basis of the testimony and all the exhibits introduced by the government were fraudulently obtained by the witness at the behest and in cooperation with the FBI, an agency of the United States government, which agency financed his activities. Such activity, Mr. Iserman contended for the defense, was unconstitutional, undemocratic, and incident to a police state. There was more along the same line. And to all of it, Judge Medina replied, "Motion denied." Subsequently, he commented, "As I understand it, you and your colleagues take the view that if someone with knowledge of the FBI is in places where they observe persons who are later charged with a crime, that what they see and hear is protected by the constitutional provisions and may not be proven." In his summation of the prosecution's case at the end of the long trial, United States Attorney John F.X. McGoey made several points based upon testimony I had given. "When they reconstituted the party in 1945, he said, "they went back to the old Communist Party, organized to establish socialism in the United States according to Marxist-Leninist teaching. That teaching is, as the evidence shows, that socialism can be established only by the violent overthrow and destruction of our constitutional form of government, through the smashing of the machinery of government and the setting up of the dictatorship of the proletariat by violent and forceful seizure of power under the leadership of the Communist Party." If this were a legitimate American political party seeking members to gain office by the ballot, one would think that one vote would be as good as another, one recruit as good as another. But we find that throughout the indictment period, party recruiting drives were aimed at workers from the key industries. Why this desire to have party members in the rubber, transportation, communication, auto, electrical, coal, and steel industries, and in plants where jet airplane engines were being manufactured? This policy lays bare the sinister purposes behind the defendant's activities. It was for the purpose of inculcating revolutionary theory in party members that the party operated classes and schools wherever the United States communists are to be found. Are history classes conducted in secret and unannounced, assembled in someone's apartment, or in a room entered through a dentist's office or at a rural camp? Are history classes confined to selected members of the Communist Party? Students at these schools were instructed not to use their regular names or their full names. Such conditions of secrecy are unnecessary to study history, but the defendants apparently believed such conditions necessary for their schools. These schools were held to train professional revolutionaries. No matter where the school was conducted, in any part of the United States, or who the teacher was, or whether the classes were for beginners or advanced students, certain texts in those revolutionary theory and practice were regularly used. Those are the books which we have placed in evidence here, and here they are. My work was done. As soon as my testimony was completed, I flew that evening to Boston, and I went back to my job with American Theaters Corporation. My neighbors and my fellow workers welcomed me back. Everyone was highly amused at the turn of events. None of them said, "I knew it all the time." There were a number of newspaper, magazine, and radio offers. While there was no compulsion involved, the Department of Justice had made it plain that they would prefer me not to elaborate on my public testimony, at least while the trial was still in progress. I turned down all offers. My services to the Bureau naturally were ended. The comrades in the party shunned me. I encountered a few of them on the Boston streets. Most of them ducked me. Once I met Boone Shermer, and he snarled at me and turned his back. There remained a few old friends who had turned away from me because of distaste for my various activities, whom I wanted to see again. Foremost among them was Gordon Case, my old schoolmate and companion from my first days of the Cambridge Youth Council. Gordon had walked out on me at the Touraine Hotel meeting in 1941, when I had embraced the new communist line on the war after Russia had been attacked by Germany. I had not seen him since. Now he wrote me a long letter saying that he was happy to know the truth of my associations with the communists and to find what he had feared had turned out to be unfounded. I received many other letters, a few from malcontents and cranks, but most of them in support of my work, from persons in all walks of life throughout the country. The 11 stand convicted, their conviction affirmed by the United States Supreme Court. They were sentenced to prison and given the maximum term under the law, 5 years. After having served their terms in jail, they returned to the communist ranks to work harder than ever before toward their never-changing goal, the destruction of freedom in America and throughout the world. Subsequent attempts by the Department of Justice to secure convictions of second-string communist leaders were thwarted by the Warren Court. Hence, the Communist Party and its conspirators are still at large. The control of the party and its violent revolutionary doctrine remains a paramount question of national policy. I'm almost sad to see the end of this. This has been so great. Some things that jump out at me here was in the closing statements of the prosecutor. When they reconstituted the party in 1945, he said, they went back to the old Communist Party organized to establish socialism in the United States according to Marxist-Leninist teaching. That teaching is, as the evidence shows, that socialism can be established only by violent overthrow and destruction of our constitutional form of government through the smashing of the machinery of government and the setting up of the dictatorship of the proletariat by violent and forceful seizure of power under the leadership of the Communist Party. What I'm sure most of you know, as I've talked about this before, and many of you are well-versed in history and the structure of our form of government, as we live in a constitutional republic. And every state as part of the union must guarantee a republican form of government. And that's the opposite and the antithesis of what communists want to institute in America, what they want to have, what they want to see. Another quote here says, "The catalog of inflammatory literature and party teachings continued from Stalin's Foundations of Leninism, properly introduced as the very book used by me in the Hancock Street School. The prosecution brought out Stalin's view that Lenin is therefore right in saying the proletarian revolution is impossible without the violent destruction of the machinery of the bourgeoisie state and its replacement by new machinery." He condemned the party again by this passage from the same book. "Only the revolutionary party of the proletariat can serve as this general staff. The working class without a revolutionary party is an army without a general staff. The party is a general staff of the proletariat. Lenin is therefore right in saying the proletarian revolution is impossible without the violent destruction of the machinery of the bourgeoisie state and its replacement by new machinery." The communists have not gone anywhere. They continue to work in our government. They continue to be seen everywhere. They're seen in, they've changed, as I've talked about, they've changed from a Soviet communism to a Maoist communism. They're, instead of using class so much, they use it a little, but more often than not, they're using race. They're using division. And what the communists did in the Soviet communism, Russia, was divide people by the classes. You had the rich and the poor, the bourgeoisie. That would be you and me, by the way. But what the Maoists did was divided people by race. Oh, it's this group, getting down on the other group, and all the same Marxism, but different method by which the division is created. So now we're seeing this now. You see it all the time. Black Lives Matter, woke culture, the woke industrial complex that we are finding everywhere now. So I'm going to, next week, as I read the epilogue, I'm going to talk about some different things that kind of bring out some of the history of what was going on there. I'm going to try and, I'm going to find some articles that were written at the time about this and talk about what was the reaction. And I think it should be interesting. Herb had so much that he had sent to the FBI. They couldn't not convict these people. But what I found interesting was apparently you can work for the violent overthrow of our government and only get 5 years in jail for it. Very interesting. I don't know if that's still true. My guess is probably not. And if it is true, that it would only apply to conservatives that they could, somehow get with these charges of this nature. I hope everyone had a wonderful Mother's Day and spent some good time with your moms. And I know that we did. We had a great time. We went up to King Family Vineyards. It was really windy, actually, but it was very nice. But man, they were mask Nazis. Like, I've not seen. I don't know if it's their proximity to the north or what it was, but it was, we're talking a whole level of next level of fascism, sticking your arm straight out and screaming Sieg Heil. I mean, that's the level of mask Nazism that they were engaging in. I mean, we're talking, they had a lady driving around in the golf cart selling wine. You couldn't even walk up to her outside without wearing a mask. So we'll see what happens to these businesses when the restrictions are lifted in July, I believe it is, or June. It's coming one way or another. But I think that what you're going to see with the lifting of these things is that a lot of these corporations who are instituting government policy, aka fascism, are going to use the excuse that, well, this is a new company policy. We're requiring that you do this. So we'll see how that works out for them. I'd like to thank you for listening. Remind you that you were not made to fit in. You were born to stand out. I'm Hank Reardon. This is Radio Free Virginia. God bless you.